Thanks to Toby for the update. Welcome back, Grant and Danny on the Fan, brought to you by the law firm Condori and Murrah. They'll get you squared away on all the important paperwork you need, including a living trust, medical power of attorney. You can go get a free consultation with their attorneys, Fairfax offices, kmlawyers.com to set it up. Mention us, get a discount, kmlawyers.com. Danny, the Nats didn't play last night. They had a day off as part of a 9-game, 10-day road trip out west.
Mm-hmm.
They take on the Angels tonight. It has come to my attention like a cinder block landing on my foot. Times are just bleak for this fan base. It's obvious and it's kind of out there all the time.
But every once in a while you get a little smack in the face of reality.
Yeah, it hit me pretty hard last night and I was just kind of down in the dumps about it.
Like, I can delude myself when they're beating San Diego 10-6 and Wood and Abrams are both 3-for-5 or whatever it is, and I had fun watching the game. Hey, that's going to be fine for true. What are they, 3-15 in June or something close to it?
So here's kind of what got me into the tailspin last night. So The news came out, end of the show yesterday, that James Wood not only wasn't a finalist to be a starter in the All-Star game. I mean, it's not even close, right? You get 6 outfielders that get the most votes that move forward to have a chance to be one of the 3 starting outfielders for the league. Now, it's possible that a bunch of guys don't go or someone stubs their toe or somebody's wife's having a baby and maybe James Wood correctly gets to start. That's the hope. Although I hope that the stubbing of the toe isn't too serious. But he wasn't close. I mean, the support for James Wood, both nationally, where he's 22 and he's first season, so he's just not a household name yet. That's changing with every at-bat and every game and every week at this point. But certainly locally, I mean, the fan support was just minimal for a guy of his success level and his caliber. He, in a ballot that's just done by polling fans, any minute, any hour of any day, you can go vote for your favorite national to make the All-Star game. And to be fair and honest about this, I mean, when the Nats were really, really good, they didn't do great in All-Star balloting. You know, some years the Braves would have like 7 All-Stars.
Yeah, it's like a cultural thing. Yeah. For whatever reason, if you play for the Braves, you get in the All-Star game.
Well, I can tell you, it's not a mystery. Their fans vote a lot.
Well, that's what it is. Yeah, that's what the fan base. Yeah.
But the Reds, the Cardinals, like there are these years where they get out the vote, they stuff the ballot, the team is good, the Cubs have had this, and like 6 of their guys are in the starting lineup. Even when the Nats were the best team in the National League over a several-year span, that never happened. There was a year where Zim would start or Rendon would start or what have you, but it's just never been a thing, right? So I bring this up to say that James Wood ends up 9th in NL balloting among outfielders. At worst, you can make the case that he's number 2 among outfielders this year in the National League in quality of performance. I would put him 1. He's got the highest OPS, and he's swinging for the fences with the power and a terrible lineup with little help or support. What he's doing is incredible. He's on pace for 40-plus home runs, which no National has done since they've come to Nationals Park. He's on pace for well over 100 RBI. He'll be the number 2 RBI season in Nationals history. Again, in a bad lineup in his first big league season, only behind Anthony Rendon when they were a World Series caliber club. But the votes weren't there. I tweeted something to the effect of it's a shame. I understand why, by the way. I'm not blaming anyone. This just stinks that we're in this situation where James Wood has this kind of year, and hopefully baseball does the right thing. I'd be shocked if they didn't. He'll likely be an All-Star. I'm almost going to guarantee it. It would be an outrage if he wasn't. But now we're leaving it up to baseball to do right by James Wood.
Right.
And the responses, as you can imagine, were blame the learners. Blame the team. Not our fault. They've lost the fan base. And all of these things are true. When you're not engaged, when you don't spend, when you don't field a major league caliber product for year over year over year, when you're playing bad baseball, when you're part of a losing outfit and the team is losing, it is true that interest dwindles and people don't go to the game in the same numbers, which we're seeing. They're just outside, I believe, of the top 20 in attendance this year. But the atmosphere at Nats Park right now is brutal. And I was over, I think I went to every game on the last homestand. I may have missed one, but you know, they announced 11,000 in one of those games against the Rockies. That's what they announced. When they're announcing something, that's a lot more than are actually sitting there. You know what I'm saying? And they did also announce in that series 20-plus a couple of times. But it's bad in terms of how many people are coming. And it's not just who comes. Like, the energy in the ballpark, sometimes is really good on that particular homestand as they were losing over and over and over again.
In the midst of 11 straight, yeah.
To terrible teams, Miami and Colorado. It was just not a fun place to be. And the irony, by the way, as the Bananas are getting ready to do some dances and shake their hips tonight in front of 40,000 is not lost on me, right? They didn't go out and spend in free agency, but we'll go watch them. I'm kidding. Everyone relax. The point of the dude's story is it's just bleak right now. It should be a fun time. We're halfway through the year where this was the corner was being turned. And 3 weeks ago, maybe it's closer to a month now, it looked like maybe it was. They were three games from 500 coming off of a heater. The closest they've been in this rebuild. They've got the number one pick in the draft 2 weeks from now, which is super exciting and awesome. They might have the best pitcher in the minor leagues right now in Travis Acora and the best young bat in the big leagues in James Wood. So it's not all bad, but it sure as hell feels like it.
It does feel that way. And, you know, we've seen this sliding scale. Sliding scale isn't the right term, but the scale of investment in sports franchises here locally firsthand. With the then Redskins, then WFT, now stupid name, right? Where it went from anger, people still showed up as recently as 2015, 2016, to apathy. And when you go from anger to apathy, it takes a special, crazy, ridiculous, absurd thing, if anything, to bring it back. Apathy is the single worst thing that can happen. It was the mistake that, Snyder made plenty, but that regime under him for so many years never understood this. They were so concerned with someone saying something negative about them, trying to control a narrative, versus you're lucky people are still saying anything at all. The worst thing that can happen to a sports franchise or anything in general is apathy, not anger. Anger means I'm disappointed in the results of the weekend series.
Yes.
My team I thought was going to be pretty good. Now they're just 500. I'm annoyed about that, but I'm still engaged. A lack of engagement is death. Apathy is sports death. We are in apathy.
I believe you're right on
right
that.
Right now. And I think, and it's the only way out of it is that there's a game of chicken, it seems to me, between ownership. And again, it's not like I've talked to anybody. I have no sources on this, but just looking at what you guys are looking
eyeballs.
At. Sure. Yeah. I have two eyes working and I have some ears that don't work that great, according to my wife. But the point of the dude's story is I'm watching this all take place. There seems to be a game of chicken. We're not building it until they come, we're not coming until they build it. And we're just staring at each other.
See, I've never gotten the first one. I've never gotten that sense that that's what they're saying. What, in fact, publicly, they have not said that. What they have said is, when we're ready to win, we'll spend. And then the baseball people this offseason said we're ready to win, but they didn't spend. And so now there was a piece in the Svrluga column today, and if you didn't check it out in the Post, it was really good about basically the fact that the Nats are the second worst team in baseball over several years behind the Rockies. And a lot of the things that they just haven't done very well and how bad things have been with drafting and developing. And you know, I think everybody knows the ownership part. He was saying there's more to it than that. But the end of the column I thought was really interesting in this regard where he basically said, he had a quote from spring training. I think he talked to Mark Lerner. And Lerner said something to the effect of, I'll pull it up, but when Mike Rizzo comes to me this offseason and says he wants to spend, we'll talk about it then. And Rizzo goes, get ready for the conversation. But my point is, it's not like they didn't have that damn conversation last offseason right. When they should have spent and didn't.
And that's why I think this ownership group is simply saying we're not doing it until they come back. Talking about the fans.
But maybe. I don't know. I mean,
again, I'm speculating.
That
but
doesn't make any sense, though.
But that's exactly why it makes sense. We're not going to spend until people come see us. The baseball reasons were obvious. The baseball reasons are smacking you in the face like a fish. Just whacking you right over the head. Wake up. Oh my God, we're so close. We have a great young core. Spend a medium amount of money and you could win 80 games. They didn't do that because people aren't coming. People aren't buying the season tickets.
But
people aren't buying the stuff.
That's not why, in my opinion. They didn't do it because they have no interest in spending money again. That's
right.
My take on it.
Because people aren't coming. I think it's a direct relationship. But I can have no proof so we can go around in circles.
Yeah.
Point is, they're not spending. And people see that. People are aware of that.
But why would that be the case now? They spent before to get people to come when
yes.
Nobody was coming.
Pandemic happened. Everything fell off a cliff. The patriarch passed away, sadly. We know the story.
Right.
Less invested people, more looking at it as a business. Their other business interests are waning. We need this to be a positive operator. It's not. We are not spending another dime past this ceiling until we can start making a profit. The way to make a profit is people come in droves And we're not spending until they come
so
in droves.
I agree with every word you just said. Until I just don't think whether people come or not has anything to do with it. I think if 40,000 people went to the ballpark every single night between now and the end of the year, the offseason would look the exact same coming up.
Fair enough. Yeah, possible to prove either way.
I think
way.
You got to make phone calls to let them know, you know, other than Mark Lerner, like what nights the team's going to be there at this point. I mean, I'm being hyperbolic, mm-hmm. but here's my point to get back to the fan base, though, and how dark and ominous and bleak this just feels, right? We talked about the James Wood walk-off home run against the Rockies.
Yep.
We did post-game, actually, on the team's network that day,
mm-hmm.
on the radio network. You and I are on the air, and the first caller in says, I'm conflicted on how to feel today. And we go, what do you mean? And he said, well, I want to be really happy about the James Wood home run, but whenever he does anything good, I get sad because I know it's only a matter of time before he's gone. And I get 50 of these tweets to every single positive one anytime James Wood is mentioned at any point during a baseball game. It's just a bunch of people making the same terrible joke about whether he's going to play for the Dodgers or the Yankees. And these are jokes that they've allowed and brought on themselves with how they operated and the fact that they have never re-signed any of their own other than Steven Strasburg. That's the only guy ever that they have extended among their superstar collection. Which is funny because we talk about it all the time as, well, Scott Boras doesn't get deals done. You know, you don't sign Scott Boras guys ahead of the market. It's a Boras problem. And Dylan Cruz is a Boras guy, and James Wood's a Boras guy. But C.J. Abrams isn't, so maybe you re-sign him. Well, here's the little secret. They haven't re-signed any of the guys that aren't Boras guys either. Now, there haven't been a lot of those, but Trey Turner was not a Boras guy. That was a terrible contract. The Phillies signed him to 11 and 300.
Mm-hmm.
But 3 or 4 years earlier, it's not like they got a deal done with him.
Right.
C.J. Abrams is not a Boras guy. They making good progress on that extension? I'm not so sure.
Mm-hmm.
So it is true that when you have Boras's players, they're almost always going to go to the market, especially if they're stars, because he can reset the market, see Juan Soto. And you can offer him whatever you want to, and short of just handing Boras a blank check, you're not going to get a deal done. But until they lock up an Abrams or go get in your time machine, you know, a Trey Turner or whoever it might be, it's not just a Boras problem. There have been some non-Boras players you would have wanted to re-sign that also didn't get re-signed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just so cancerous with the fan base. It's so unhealthy.
Yep.
And I promise this is not supposed to be, I hope it doesn't sound this way, my guy Bob Carpenter, who I love, had this like slap all the fans on the wrist thing a couple of weeks ago.
I love Bob Carpenter. One of my favorite memories is watching Games of the World Series
yes.
with him. Behind Charlie and Dave
in Houston.
Because there's no space for anybody. So we're just slapping high fives and
eating ice cream
yeah.
and talking baseball with Bob Carpenter between innings.
Yeah, when Kurt Suzuki hits a bomb to give him a lead in game two, like I'm high-fiving Bob Carpenter. Dream come true. But that guy's old school. That guy comes yes. from a different baseball world
if you
than
the
modern
rant,
fans.
It was something to the effect yeah. of, if you're a real fan, you got to support the team and come out here, and even though they're losing, not get upset and not call for firings or whatever. And I'm paraphrasing, but it was something along those lines.
Mm-hmm.
That is not what I'm doing at all. I'm not playing that game, okay? This is not the give the fans a verbal tongue-lashing or something. What I am saying, though, is I have always been able to separate like my disdain from ownership
mm-hmm.
with the joy I get at 7:05 when the first pitch is thrown, or my interest in going to the ballpark, because I've grown up hating the owners of my teams mostly.
Yeah.
Peter Angelos in Baltimore before the Nats existed when I was grew up a diehard Orioles fan, couldn't stand Dan Snyder. It was just what it was.
It was a who's who. Yeah.
I hate the owners. I love the teams. And it does not change how excited I get when James Wood hits a home run that he might not be here eventually. I know most people don't view it that way. It doesn't change whether I want to go to the ballpark or not because the Lerners have stopped spending. I'm not suggesting that you guys should do it your own way. I'm telling you that's fine. But it's just something that I don't always relate to. But right now, here's the state of this fan base, is that I think people are basically waiting that either the ownership reengages and spends, and there's no sign that that's on the table right
Correct.
Now, or they sell the team. And if we're being honest, the team's currently off the market, but let's say they re-engage in wanting to sell the team, no one's buying the team until after the CBA at this point, because there's a very good chance, almost a lock, depending on who you talk to, that there's going to be a lot of weeks without baseball when the new CBA kicks in. So there's two seasons left, right?
Mm-hmm.
But after, in December of 26, with this new CBA at this point, that would be what you're going to probably sell the team after that, because someone's not buying a team to then possibly miss out on a third of or a half of or multiple months of a season where they just don't make any cash. So let's say they wanted to sell the team right now. A, there's only been one suitor that we know of in Ted Leonsis. Mm-hmm. B, the timing is horrendous.
Yep.
So I think there's less of a chance they sell the team in short order than that they spend again. I don't think there's much of a chance that they spend any real money again. They may spend on a player, but the offseason they need to have this year is like going out and getting Michael King to be in the rotation and Kyle Tucker to be in the outfield. They're not doing that.
Right.
That is not even like reality. And if you're a fan, you go, well, look, they'll make changes. They're going to blow some people out and tweak the staff. Rizzo said on the air a couple of weeks ago with the Junkies, they're not changing anything. They're not firing Davey. So they're just losing, and there's not even the interest of like watching the crash to go, well, when are they going to make the change? Now the losses pile up, and at least during that Rocky series, you're like, is he going to get fired tonight? Is he going to get fired tomorrow?
There's intrigue.
Fans don't have that anymore because Rizzo basically told you it's not happening. And oh, by the way, lastly, all the kids have been called up. Like the last one to come that was the big impact guy that was anywhere close to ready was Brady House, and he's here now. So you've got Cruz coming back from injury with Wood, with House. I mean, Cade Cavalli, if you want to count him, will be up next month. That'll be cool to see again. But otherwise, that's the end for the season of the call-ups and the promotions that matter.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, it's going to be a grind the rest of the way for this fan base.
Yeah, it's bleak. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it other than that. Something dramatic has to change. And that was my point is, like, you're worried about apathy setting in. Stop worrying. It has set in. This is what it looks like. It looks like this, where there's no carrot to dangle. There's no light at the end of the tunnel. At least for a while during this rebuild, you could go, all right, you could squint. You could see these months that Abrams is putting together. Where what if he puts together a whole season similar to that? Then he's an all-star. What if James Wood is good? What if Robert Hassel comes back from injury and is the real deal? What if one of these guys that they pick high turns out to be a quality major leaguer, this pitcher, that? So some of the core, you can go, okay, I could see it down the line, down the line. And it's fine we're losing 95 games.
Yeah.
Now they're here. Now there's no more end of the tunnel stuff because all the kids are up and you have offseason after offseason. And you're still doing the Nelson Cruz deal. You're still doing the Nick Senzel deal.
You're lucky if your Nelson Cruz was $15 million.
Well,
they haven't signed
much.
Anybody for that much since.
I was picking up a guy they're trying to spin at the deadline. You're still doing Nick Senzel.
$2 million. That's what they've been doing the last 3 years.
And deferring them over 5 years.
Right.
That's what you're doing now. You're doing bargain basement, hoping he's okay, trade him for a middling prospect.
I'd be doing cartwheels for Nelson Cruz deals. It's been 4 years since they've done one of those. I guess my point is, in summation, that it's not your fault. Fans, it's not. But when James Wood has the half that he's had and he finishes ninth in balloting, and then he's on a road trip where he sees 40,000 plus at Dodger Stadium going nuts, and he sees 40,000 plus in San Diego going nuts, and it's just a vicious cycle. You're mad that guys aren't signing here forever. Why would anyone want to be here for 15 years at this point? You see what I'm saying?
Of course I do.
I go on the road and I see twice as many people that care way more, and oh, by the way, I am maybe the best player at my position in the sport, and I'm barely top 10 in fan balloting. Where do I sign up to not go anywhere else? I mean, I'm not blaming anybody. It's all part of a vicious circle right now, but it's reality, and it stinks. Grant and Danny on the Fan. Charles Allen, D.C. council member, talking stadium with us live next. Welcome back to Grant and Danny on the Fan. We got a lot of questions we want to get to the bottom of with the ongoing discussion between the city council and the commanders on the stadium, RFK 2.0. So we got our guy on, Charles Allen, D.C. council member, who's been on the show many times now and is always very candid with us. And we don't always have to see eye to eye, but at the end of this thing, I think we high-five and go our separate ways. Is it okay if we call you our guy now, Charles? Can we do that?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon to you as well. So can you answer my main question that I kept asking yesterday, which is, was I lied to or not? Okay. Mendelsohn said that there's a quote from him where he said that they're not going to be taking the funding out of the budget. And then the DC Examiner report came out and said that they're trying to take the stadium out of the budget. Is this semantics where he's saying it's still in the budget but being set aside, or did he change his mind?
I'm never going to try to speak for another councilman, but here's what I know has happened. So when the mayor sent the budget down to us, that's when she put the RFK Stadium deal enmeshed and embedded within that. What I understand the chairman to be doing is essentially drawing a circle around the money that would be involved in a stadium deal, putting that off to the side, and in the legislative language so that we can deal with the stadium as a standalone piece of legislation. So the funding is all still there and kind of a circle drawn around it so nobody can kind of go touch it for the moment. And then we deal with the legislation as a standalone. So that's what I understand to be happening. And that allows us, frankly, to have the time. I mean, when the ballpark, now the ballpark was in front of us, the council spent 11 months examining that and ultimately voting on it. When Audi Field was in front of us, that was 6 or 7 months and then ultimately a vote. I think we're on a much faster timeline than that actually here, but we were hired to do a job. And so we're not going to rush our way through it. We got to make sure we spend the time to examine this. And it's not a good deal that's in front of us. And so there's a lot of us that say, if it's going to happen, it's got to get a lot better.
So what is the bigger issue then? Because the last part you say is not a good deal. That's debatable. And that is continuing to be debated by a lot of people. But the other part is we need more time. We don't have enough time. So what is the issue? That the deal's not good or that you need more time?
Well, both. I mean, I don't know the last time you spent over $1 billion, but you probably didn't do it in just a couple of weeks. So you got to spend a little time being able to look at it. We have a independent economic analysis that's taking place. It'll come back in the next couple of weeks. We've got tons of questions that have gone out that we don't have answers to. Spend it a few weeks, spend it a few months to make sure you get it right for when you're talking about over $1 billion. I mean, this is the second largest public subsidy for a stadium in American history. You got to get that right. So we're going to take our time and make sure we do that.
Councilmember Charles Allen with us here on Grant and Danny. So what are some of those questions, Councilmember, that you say haven't been answered yet that you're looking for answers to?
Oh, great question. So right now, you know, we're trying to figure out, so how is this thing financed? So right now, let's take a look at the parking. I've been very critical of 8,000 parking spaces. That's way too much. But right now, the deal is structured that not only does DC taxpayers build all these massive parking lots that'll sit empty most of the time, but all the parking revenue goes to the team. They don't pay any taxes on it. That's not even how we deal with the other parking lots. So have they built the financing that they're putting in based off of just taking all your parking money and skipping over the tax dollars? What are some of the fundamentals and financials around this deal? Those are the types of questions you got to ask. How are you going to move 65,000 people here? I've got a whole series of questions to our metro system with the commander saying, help me understand how you're going to move people in and out of here. Those are questions that your legislative body, your elected leaders have got to get answers to. So there's a ton of things we're still trying to make sure we understand.
How many parking spots for you wouldn't be too many? Because you say 8,000 is too many, and it's already a sticking point with fans and probably with the team as not being ideal and not being enough.
Well, I disagree. I mean, there's no way you need 8,000 parking spaces. You've got Metro, for example, you got Stadium Armory right there. We've been talking about it for 20 years about building a new Metro station there at Oklahoma and Binning. You've got a 42,000 seat stadium at Nats Ballpark with 1,200 parking spaces, and that works pretty well because you got Metro a block away.
But you
remember,
know, there's no tailgating culture with baseball.
Though. Remember, this is giving all the land around it away. So we're talking about 20,000 new residents. You're talking about a stadium, a lot here. The future has got to be, how are we getting people here by transit, by metro, not how are we driving everybody in? Traffic's already a mess. Now imagine 8 or 10,000 more cars trying to squeeze themselves in there. That's not going to work very well. We got to get people there by transit.
So I'd have to look at, I'm trying to find stadium by stadium in the NFL, some of these urban stadiums, but the average that I'm seeing is 20 to 25,000.
You were looking at suburban stadiums, if that's what the numbers you're looking at. There are stadiums that are able to make it work with less parking.
Right. I'm just saying that's what it returned as the average for the NFL stadiums at this point. But, yeah, I'll take your word for it. I don't think that's...
Am I trying to build a stadium or am I trying to build a whole neighborhood? Remember, what we've been build this around is it's an opportunity to build a stadium, but really it's about building out a whole new neighborhood, an entire area. This is 180 acres. So if you were to be building a small city from scratch, would you expect that you'd want to build just parking garages everywhere for people to drive? Or would you expect in a city that you've got your metro system, that you want to get people in and out by metro? those are a lot of the questions we're looking at. You've got a river that is going to change the way you can access this point, this spot, and get into this space. So you've got to really think about this and get it right.
Totally understand that and get that. I feel like they knew when the plans came out, the mayor and the team, though, with 8,000 spots, that, you know, with the $189 million sports facility for the youth and some of the, or whatever that number is, all of the stuff that's involved in this program, I think they have a lot of that stuff, don't they? I mean, when you say it's a neighborhood, not a stadium, that's kind of the idea on their side too, no?
They have talked a lot, but let's talk about the housing. Great example. So the goal is to build the DC law, the bare minimum is 30% of the new homes built would have to be affordable homes, because we want this to be a place that everybody can afford to live in and call home, right? There's nothing, absolutely nothing in the deal that requires that affordable housing to be built. I think we need to look at, you know, just across the Potomac River, when Amazon HQ2 is coming in, they actually put in a lot of smart ways that public subsidy got clawed back if the housing didn't get developed, because there could be a lot of ways in which the promises aren't kept in terms of building the housing. That, to me, is one of the details that could change in this deal. Let's make sure we actually write in, when does that housing have to get developed? When does it get delivered? Who are we building for? And if you don't do it like you promised, then we want our public subsidy back. It creates the incentives there, because if this is a partnership, it's got to go both ways, because right now it is a one-way deal.
Councilmember Charles Allen with us here on Grant and Danny. So the questions that you're asking, the things that you're advocating for, et cetera, they're not going to us. They're not going out into the ether. You're probably communicating with economists, independent folks that you see are reviewing these things, the team, the mayor, et cetera. Yep. How are those dialogues going? Is progress being made? And kind of walk us through that and the timeline.
I actually think it is going well. I mean, the commanders have never resisted coming to the table and talking. That's a good sign. When we've highlighted where our questions are, I think the commanders thus far have been really forthcoming. You know, from what I understand from Chairman Mendelson, who's helping lead a lot of this, you know, not as forthcoming from the mayor, but I think the commanders for their part have been sharing a lot of information. Getting the economics are an important part. We do have budget and economists that are taking a look at it to make sure they inform our decisions and how it moves forward. But we're going to have public hearings on July 28th and 29th, I believe, or maybe it's 29th and 30th. But I think there's already over 200 people signed up to testify. It's going to be a long couple of days for those hearings, but that's going to create the public venue and public feedback. We're going to get a lot more people to come in and tell us what they like, what they don't like, what do they want to see changed, what do they want to see protected. And then I would expect that sometime in the fall, we move towards a vote.
So when you say it's going well, that's good. For the team, though, they were hoping this would be wrapped up in the summer. And they put out a statement, I believe yesterday, maybe the day before, suggesting that July 15th is still vital here. And you just said you're going to have hearings 2 weeks after that, and you're talking about the fall, which is not the same timeline as theirs. And it sounds like maybe even in the fall that you're hoping to agree to a deal that isn't even on the table yet, right?
There have to be a lot of changes. And,
right.
And so that's going to take a little time, but I would expect you'd see a vote sometime in the fall. But you know,
when you say the fall, is that September? Is that November? Like, what do you mean by that?
My hunch would be it's more in the September-October timeframe, but there's not a set date on that. But listen, if you were the commanders or if you're the mayor, of course you're going to tell everybody, gosh, it's got to happen by this date or everything falls apart. Listen, the commanders have made no secret. They want to be in D.C. And D.C. is coming in full faith, working hard to figure out, is there a deal that can be had here and what changes have to happen? So people need to have a little bit of ice water in their veins here and realize, like, this is a $1 billion industry. We're all talking to each other and working toward what will ultimately be a decision.
So essentially you're calling their bluff.
What bluff to call? It's not going to happen by July 15th. So it's an artificial deadline that people want to put on us for what?
But they could go back to Maryland and get the project started if they wanted to.
Really? Governor Moore is already talking about the future of that site and how he finally has a chance to do something different there. That's not going to happen. This is so different than what you saw take place in Virginia, where D.C. worked hard to get Cap 1 back, which should never even gotten to that place. The dynamics are not playing out similarly here. You've got a commander's team that wants to be in D.C. You've got D.C. leaders that are in good faith negotiating and working with the team on that. So I'm not worried about a July 15th date at all. I don't think you should be either.
So that actually, if that's true, then that's a huge development for me and would completely change my tone on the whole thing. You don't think there's a chance that they pivot back to Maryland and say, we can't keep waiting. Because I know from talking to them, they say 2030, opening of the stadium, both for the events that they can host in it, and because that is their plan and the commitment they've made to their fans to get out of their current terrible stadium, that they're working back from that date. And maybe that's the bigger priority than being in the city. But your point is, there's nothing to worry about. Don't be frustrated by all of this happening. It's 1,000% going to be D.C., and we're not going to screw it up.
It's a more than $1 billion investment with a $1 billion industry. So don't pretend there aren't going to be like pressure points that people are going to try to put on folks. Everyone needs to take a breath. Like I said, put a little bit of ice water in your veins and realize this is a big deal. It's a big decision. Everybody's working in good faith, trying to figure out, can that plane be landed? But there's nothing that changes if you want to focus on a 2030 season. There's nothing that changes if the vote takes place July 15th versus September or even October. I think the one piece that I've seen folks throw out is, gosh, we don't want to miss out on the FIFA World Cup 2031 bid. Those bids aren't due until the end of November. So when people try to convince you that there's some magic in July, that's just not true. And I've talked with folks with U.S. Soccer. They're like, as long as you have a decision made by the end of November so your bid comes in, you're fine. So everyone needs to take a breath here and make sure we get a good deal, because this is a decision we live with for the next 50 to 75 years. It's going to outlast you and me. We've got to make sure we make the right decision for the future of our city, for the future of this part of our city, and make sure that it's the right deal for DC taxpayers. Because right now, it's not a good deal. But there is an opportunity to make it a good one, and that's what people should be working toward.
Councilmember, my last one for you along those lines is, you know, how amenable is everybody to getting that good deal, right, that satisfies enough parties? I imagine everyone in different wards might have different things they bring to the table, different asks, which makes sense to me. You're representing, a different neighborhood, a different subsection of people. How close are we to that? How amenable are all the different parties to make those compromises?
You know, I've been talking with a bunch of my colleagues, and I think there's a lot of shared vision and shared goals about the changes that we need to see. That's everything from the economics. I mean, to have the Commanders not pay rent or property taxes is just a non-starter, right? So there's economics that happen. Seeing sales tax, it just goes to go back into the stadium rather than all the sales tax that everyone wants to talk about. Why would you not want to see that invested in your schools and public safety and housing? Investing in Metro rather than on parking lots. I'm working with my colleagues. I think there's a lot of shared consensus around how we're going to be able to land this plane and come up with a very solid set of the changes that I think we all need to see.
Did you like the Nats Park deal when it was struck?
I mean, there's parts of it, yes, parts of it, no. But I think that it's been a
smashing success, right?
Well, yeah, but as you and I have talked before, we're talking about a ballpark where you have 200-plus events
Understood.
Per year versus 20 to 25 at a stadium. So they're fundamentally different.
I agree. I just saw the news, though, that it paid off 10 years early and that, between that, Capital One Arena, and Audi Field.
No. I'm glad you brought that up because I want to note that.
Yes.
There's nothing about the ballpark why the bonds are being paid off early. That's... Two-thirds of the ballpark fee that go into that come from taxes around the rest of the city. That's a choice that the city's making to free up our ability to finance this deal. And we have to actually pay a penalty to do it. So paying off the bonds at the ballpark has nothing to do with, hey, isn't it been successful?
Interesting.
Because two-thirds of the money that go into the ballpark fee come from other places all over the city. And we're actually going to have to pay a penalty to pay that off. So we're paying more. That's all about freeing up debt cap space so that we can do financing for another deal.
Gotcha. No, that's good to know. I still would say it's a success sitting in the Navy Yard right now working.
I don't disagree.
And
I don't
we wouldn't have been doing that otherwise, but yeah.
I don't disagree with you. That part's been very successful, but in terms of paying off the bonds early, that's not a link you can make around the success around the ballpark. Creating a venue that has more than 200 events per year, big major events, that drives success. That's why you heard me early on arguing for the arena, locking down the Nats to get a renewed lease, but a football stadium with 20 to 25 events is a fundamentally different thing than something that happens all year long.
Yeah, we've talked about that many, many times. All right, last one. You see why we like having Charles Allen on, answers every question we've got for him, goes back and forth with us.
You're going to ask me who we should draft first with the Nats?
No, but I would like to ask you.
I love your input there, actually.
You could come on Bustin' Loose Baseball with me and Toby Altizer.
Tate Anderson has got to be your number one pick. Like, that's just a no-brainer.
I'm a Tate Anderson guy. My co-host wants Ethan Holliday. He wants to have the regional rivalry with the Orioles. Here's my question. Mark Seagraves floated this today on our station. He said, when RFK was first built, it was built by the federal government. Plan B could be an end around of the D.C. government and going to the federal government. Your reaction to that?
I think what you're going to see is, you know, kind of scare tactics like that, trying to create pressure campaigns, right? I mean, you could say that about just about every single thing in D.C. right now, that somehow Donald Trump and a federal government wants to take over this, that, or the other. The reality on the ground is the commanders are at the table. The city is at the table. People are talking. People are working. So I don't lose a wink of sleep over the fact that people are in good faith trying to figure out what has to change, what has to change to make this a better deal and a fair deal for D.C. and D.C. taxpayers. Can we get there? Can we land the plane? There's a lot of cool heads in the room. Let's not get too distracted by the higher temperatures that might be somewhere else.
Charles Allen, boys and girls, you're my guy. I just need you to get this done and not screw this up for me. Let's have a football stadium. D.C., nation's capital, we should have a football stadium. Let's do it. Let's do this thing together.
Well, you're going to tell, and I'm sure you're telling the commanders as well, that why would they not move their headquarters in D.C.? If they say this is their spiritual home, if they say this is the place they want to be, why are they so afraid to put their headquarters here? They'd be the only franchise in D.C., not headquartered in D.C. Tell me how that makes any sense.
I will pass that along to them when I talk to them tomorrow.
There you go.
All right? I got both sides of this. We're doing this, Charles.
Thank you, sir.
We're going to get this deal done on this radio show one way or the other. We're bringing everybody
one
to the table.
One way or the other. All right. Have fun with the bananas tonight.
Appreciate
you, man.
You.
Take care. There's Charles Allen on Grant and Danny. Always like having him on the program. He answers everything.
Yes, he does.
You know, he's great to have on, so we appreciate him. Are you listening to The Fan? Let's talk to the head coach of the Wizards next. The NBA draft has come and gone. The Wizards got better, Danny, and it's time now to go to the Rude Guest Hotline. Rude, the most reliable heating and air conditioning products in the DMV. Talk to the head coach of the Washington Wizards, Brian Keefe, who's got some new players to coach up after what was a productive couple of nights.
Coach, how are you?
Great. How you guys doing?
We're very, very well. Tell us about your first-round pick, Trey Johnson. That just it oozes bucket getting.
Yeah, really thrilled to add Trey to our group, to our organization. Guy who loves basketball, who loves his craft, who is a gym rat, who works. And from all that work is the guy who's really obviously the shooting numbers and how he shoots the ball. But it's a little bit more than that, too. He's an underrated playmaker, seeing the game, but it's really his pursuit of his craft that was really drawn to us and how he really is intentional about how he wants to be and how he gets better. And that was the things that stood out to us about Trey. We're really excited to have him.
How much time did you spend around or working on evaluating him personally?
Personally, more after the season for me, we obviously have a great staff who's watching these kids for years. We have a grassroots program and, you know, we're watching these kids come up through the system. And for me specifically, I'm obviously focused about our team. And once we get after, I start watching film and diving into that stuff. But like I said, we have a great staff who unearth everything we can about these kids that put us in the best position to draft the people that we think they're going to fit in our building. And we want high character guys who love the game. And all three guys we've added are all about that.
Coach, how was it? And let me try to ask this the right way. You're in terms of minutes, right, for some of these kids. Like, just me as a fan, I'm all in, all on board with the way you guys are doing it, developing these young players, kind of turning the keys over to them as they kind of continue to earn things. What's your philosophy on minutes for young guys, knowing maybe they might not do the right thing for a while, knowing that they may not make the right decision, the right rotation, the right play here and there? How do you balance that with development and then also kind of saying, hey, maybe this one wasn't okay, so you got to learn a certain way? What's your philosophy there?
I think you learn by doing. Like, I think you probably saw from how we coached the team last year and how I coached, like, our guys led the league for rookies in minutes. I mean, I think they played almost 7,000 minutes. It was like 6,900 minutes. Like, that was like 2,000 more than anybody else. We just, you know, me and the organization have had experience with working with guys that when they get opportunities, there's going to be some learning curves, which is normal for any player. But as you can saw with some of our guys this year, Alex and Bub and Keyshawn and obviously Bilal from the year before, how much they improved by the end of the year. They were like almost different players. And I think it was a lot of it, you know, the opportunity. But they deserved the opportunity. They weren't just given that. Like, those guys deserved the chance to play, and then they performed and got better as the season was long. So that's how we look at this, is that we want to give these guys opportunities to grow. But how do you do that? You need to play in the games. So we're excited about that with these guys.
Wizards head coach Brian Keefe is with us on Grant and Danny. The Jordan Poole trade right before the draft, how much of that move was to free up minutes to run the show and run the point for Bub Carrington?
I think, you know, all those things, that's probably more of a Will and Michael question than for me. You know, I loved Jordan, and he, you know, really grew tremendously here, but that's the nature of the NBA. Things are going to change and evolve, and, you know, does that give more opportunities for other guys? And Jordan was a great producer for us last year, so someone's going to have to step in that role. Bob will be one of those guys, but it'll also be other guys we have on the roster, too. Like, you don't just do that with one person, but it does give some opportunities from guys to step up, and we're excited about that.
Coach, tell us about Will Riley.
Great feel for the game. Again, similar, all three, I'm going to say the same guy who really loves the game, wants to work, wants to be in the gym. These are like a big thing for us. It's really important. Size, versatility, sees the game really well. Good passer, good processor. Those things really stood out to us in the process of the evaluation.
Jameer Watkins, the pick last night from Florida State, 6'5", another wing. Is that someone that you think, just based on what you've studied, could help you guys this year, or is he more of a developmental piece, you think?
All those things will be determined, right, as we go, but we're excited about him and what he brings, physicality, a defense, his activity, something that really stood out in this process for us. So we were thrilled when that we were able to get him in the second round like that. It was something we really valued. We didn't have a pick originally, but then obviously with some of the movement we had, so we got a pick in the second round, and we got someone we really liked. So that one was really exciting for us. He's something that brings great value to our organization in terms of who he is as a person and what he brings. We're excited about Jameer.
Coach, great insight as always. Enjoy the offseason and really appreciate the time with us.
Thanks, guys. Look forward to talking again soon.
Sounds good, Coach. Thanks.
Thank you. There's Brian Keefe, head coach of the Wizards. Big week for Wizards basketball, led by the selection of Trey Johnson. Let's get to the Beltway Blitz next on Grant and Danny.